Today, a respite from election angst. First, a new novel examining our all-too-human blindness to our own self-destructive paths.
The idea of blindness, of our willed blindness to things we find distressing in the people we are close to, in the people we love, is for me a very persuasive one. And I love the way that vision can play tricks on us.
That's Margot Livesey, talking about her new novel, Mercury. Then, some great advice about writing that urges freedom and discipline.
Writing well requires the capacity to be as free as can be and then to take some kind of control. Letting whatever is held inside free, which gives you the potential to surprise yourself, to write something you didn't know you thought or didn't know you were going to write.
That's Alice Madison. We talk with her about her book, The Kite and the String, later in the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Margot Livesey's novels often center around the themes of regret and responsibility, truth and trust, as one reviewer wrote about her novel, The House on Fortune Street. We spoke with Livesey about that book in 2009, as well as The Flight of Gemma Hardy, her 2012 novel. Now Livesey's out with a new one, Mercury, that revisits these themes. Mercury is the name of a god and a poison. One could say both these meanings are involved in Livesey's new story, embodied in the character of a racehorse by the name of Mercury, who becomes the object of obsession by one of the novel's two protagonists, Viv. The story is told in tandem by Viv and by her husband Donald, and we follow the couple down into the very dark regions that Viv's obsession and Donald's mounting panic about it take them. Margot Livesey grew up in Scotland and has lived in the U.S. for a long time. She teaches at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop and has published 8 novels. Mercury was out in September 2016 by HarperCollins. Well, Margot Livesey, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's great to talk to you again.
This novel, Mercury, is a very absorbing story, a kind of dark story in a way. It centers around a couple, Donald and Viv, and it's told from their alternating points of view. Like you, he's from Scotland, and he's an optometrist. She manages a stables, but didn't always. Introduce us to these characters, Donald and Viv.
Donald is, perhaps in some ways, a kind of version of the schoolmasters of my youth. I grew up in the grounds of a boys' private school in Scotland where my father taught. And from my childlike perspective, the place seemed to be populated by these rather reserved men of integrity, or so I perceived them to be. And I thought, how interesting to bring someone like that to America, to a much less reserved culture, and put him in a relationship with a much less reserved person. Viv, I think of as having some of the traditional American virtues. She's optimistic, spontaneous, insightful and witty, and very, as we come to realize reading the novel, very ambitious.
And what draws these characters who are so different to each other originally?
I think that Donald sees in Viv a perfect complement to himself. He tends to, you know, to weigh the pros and cons, to hesitate and negotiate. And here's someone who says, "Oh, this is what we should do. Let's go to Provincetown for the weekend. Let's have a baby. Let's do this. Let's do that." And he really welcomes that. She introduces him to a side of himself that he didn't know existed, a side that'll go dancing in nightclubs and do much more frivolous things after his years of medical study. And Viv, I think, sees in Donald a good man, someone who won't mess her around in the way her previous boyfriends have, someone who will be loyal and supportive and allow her to have the kind of life she wants.
And yet what they see in each other in some ways leads down the primrose path to a darker place. Donald very much has a sense of obligation to family. Viv's obligations seem more to herself and her own dreams.
That's a very good way of putting it. Yes, Donald is very caught up in taking care of his father, who has developed Parkinson's and who dies shortly before the novel opens. And he's also very taken up in caring for his patients and his two children, their two children. Viv is struggling with not having the larger life she always imagined she would have. First, in her early 20s, she failed to win a vital horse riding event and realized she wasn't going to be a champion equestrian. And then she realized that she wasn't going to be wildly successful in mutual funds. And although she really likes running the riding stables with her friend Claudia, there's something missing in her life.
And she seeks to fill it, and the opportunity arises when this horse, the eponymous horse of the title, Mercury, comes to the stables. Now, Mercury is a interesting name because Mercury is not just, you know, the name of a horse, a very fast horse, but he's also a god in Greek myth, also a poison. He seems almost godlike in this book. Tell us, how does he come to be at the stables, and how did his figure grow in your mind as you were writing this?
I had ridden as a girl, perhaps like many girls. The ponies I rode were nothing like Mercury. They were Scottish Highland ponies, and they were not well trained. They would go forwards and they would stop, and that was about it. But there was also a stable nearby where a wonderful racehorse was kept, a racehorse that had once won the Grand National, like National Velvet. And I would sometimes see him and just be awed by his beauty, I suppose, the sheer muscular grace of his gait. Mercury in my novel has a rather murky past. He belongs to the brother of a woman named Hillary, and the brother dies in a riding accident, and Hillary inherits this magnificent horse without herself being someone who really likes riding and horses. And so when she brings him to Viv's stables, Viv steps forward to fill the void in caring for Mercury. And pretty quickly, one thing leads to another as she realizes that he is an incredibly well-trained horse and a superb athlete, and that he has that potential she's been looking for years to be successful.
Now, normally, you know, one might think that what transpires, her interest in the horse, her interest, she becomes interested in riding him in competitions, that this would come as a welcome thing to someone like Hillary. You know, it's like, sure, great, you know, show my horse, we'll win competitions, I'll make money, whatever may be the motivation, but it doesn't exactly transpire that way.
No, Hillary is not enthusiastic about Viv's desire to enter Mercury into competitions. And that comes out of her fear of losing Mercury. Mercury is, for her, her, in a sense, a kind of incarnation, if you will, of her dead brother, the only thing that she has left of him. And although her relationship with her brother was quite rocky, in fact, perhaps, I might say perhaps because it was quite rocky, she cherishes this horse and does worry about the many things that can befall horses when they're competing.
And yet, in a way, none of the characters are really doing what the horse maybe really needs. Mercury is almost this figure, almost an abstract figure, like I said before, almost like a god that people are worshiping for their own designs and desires instead of for himself.
And I think that's a really good way of putting it. I think people are projecting what they want onto Mercury. And in visiting stables and doing research for the novel, which was a very pleasurable part of writing it, I did find myself following people around who would tell me all these things about what a horse was thinking or feeling. And I found that very interesting, the degree to which we anthropomorphize these very large animals that have been domesticated for 5,000 or 6,000 years.
And these very large and very intelligent animals.
Yes, although their intelligence, I think, works in a different way than ours, but absolutely very intelligent.
It's interesting because recently there have been books like Beyond Words by Carl Safina, and there's a new book by Franz Duval about how we see animals. And I think the lesson is beginning to dawn on human beings that they're neither dumb beasts nor are they just like us.
Exactly. And I would say that in the case of Viv and Mercury, that Viv, in one sense, sees him very accurately, and in the other sense, almost doesn't see him at all because he's so much for her the vehicle to get where she wants to go.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Margot Livesey about her new novel, Mercury. And now, meanwhile, there's Donald. Donald is an optometrist, and blindness, vision and blindness, what one sees and when one sees it and how one misses it is very much at the center of this book. Could you talk a little bit about blindness as a theme?
Yes. As someone who's been quite short-sighted since childhood, I've spent a lot of time visiting optometrists and having people say to me, better or worse. And I became very fascinated with all the things we attribute to eyes, how we see them as a window into the soul, how we see them as a central metaphor. We talk about seeing in all kinds of ways that have nothing to do with literally seeing. And Donald shares my fascination and is someone who really wanted to be an ophthalmologist, to be a surgeon and to work at that higher level, but gives up that ambition to care for his father when his father's Parkinson's grows more acute. But the idea of blindness, of our willed blindness, if you will, to things we find distressing in the people we are close to, in the people we love, is for me a very persuasive one. And I love the way that vision can play tricks on us. And, we see people playing tricks on us in paintings, or there are, famous experiments when we judge two arrows and one seems longer than the other, but they're both the same length. And all of that, they sort of simultaneity of vision, if you will, I found really fascinating and really germane to Donald's situation as he struggles in the aftermath of the grief of losing his father.
Simultaneity of vision?
Well, I suppose that's maybe not the best way of saying it, but, sort of simultaneously seeing and not seeing something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he is aware that Viv is sailing very purposefully away from the family and making choices that he wishes she wouldn't make. But it's not until those choices have become quite extreme that he tries to intervene.
And she becomes, in fact, obsessed with Mercury and is willing to transgress a lot of boundaries in the service of that obsession. Explain how she justifies this to herself.
One of the things I found very interesting, or one of the ideas I was pursuing in the novel, was what happens when a relatively long married couple who have begun in roughly the same place, they are both left-wing liberals, if you will, when one person begins to change her mind about those shared values. And I was really interested in this somewhat different kind of adultery, or different kind of infidelity, if you will. I think Viv justifies these changes to herself quite adroitly. I mean, the first sign we get of her sort of shape-changing, if you will, is when she thinks about sending one of their children to private school, something that she had previously deplored. But you see her there making an argument for the particular, and how it's more important for Marcus to get a certain kind of education than to uphold the liberal values of public schools. And in the case of Mercury, she will do almost anything to protect him. And when she begins to feel that he's in danger because of a number of break-ins and burglaries at the stables, she goes to quite surprising lengths.
Right. And, of course, we don't want to give anything away, but there are foreshadowings in the book. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, the atmosphere built, the stories being told from two points of view? We do have a sense of how she's, you know, her partner and long friend, Claudia, she begins by transgressing boundaries with her. She transgresses boundaries with Hillary and, of course, with Donald. And ultimately, she buys a gun, which I think probably transgresses very much a values boundary that she and Donald have. So can you talk a little more about how the slow march down the primrose path occurs for her?
I think it occurs in a number of small, regrettable steps, that many of which perhaps don't at first seem too serious, that she's devoting all this time and money to Mercury, but because Claudia, her good friend who runs the stables with her, is quite critical, she begins to keep that from Claudia. She begins to hide it from Claudia. And then she begins to hide things from Hillary and from Donald, as you say. So the steps happen sort of quite gradually. And the choice to buy a gun is brought into her life by one of the girls who comes for riding lessons at the stables, and who comes from a much tougher background, a background in which guns are much more commonplace. And hearing this girl talk about them gives Viv the idea that this would be the ultimate way of protecting Mercury.
And, of course, it doesn't. You know, one question I had was, how much does the action in the book, or did you think about how much the action in the book unfolds from, you know, the consequences basically of the actions that are taken within the context of the story, and how much of it is really driven by some very deep character flaws or characteristics in the characters themselves?
That's a great question, Francesca. I think I thought a little bit of both. I mean, Richard Ford recently published a wonderful article, and I want to say in the Financial Times, about how gun ownership changes you, and how once you own a gun, just that mere fact creates certain possibilities of an alarming, distressing kind. And I was very interested in how, reading about a number of incidents in the States, how ownership in itself, ownership of a weapon, inadvertently led to things that were often, sometimes they were very fully intended, but sometimes they seemed just an awful impulse of that particular day or week. So I wanted, on the one hand, Viv to argue her way into buying a gun, to reason her way into thinking this is, in the circumstances, the right thing to do. And at the same time, to really have no sense of how doing this would change her and would create these disastrous possibilities.
We're talking with Margot Livesey about her new novel, Mercury. This is Writer's Voice. And also how this reverberates in her marriage. Because, of course, if you are engaged on your own obsessive path, but you're married to somebody else, there are inevitably consequences for them and their family. And for Donald, this puts him into a real confrontation with his own notion of obligation, particularly obligation to his family. Talk a little bit about the moral crisis that he confronts.
You're quite right. This is a huge moral crisis for Donald, and part of it centers around, you know, a major difference in values for him and Viv is that for her, horses, the well-being of horses in general and Mercury in particular is a central value, an almost unquestioned value. Donald feels like that about his patients, but he doesn't feel like that about Viv's horses, and so right from the start, there really is a division between them, a very different world view, if you will. When this terrible event happens in the novel, in the aftermath of that, Donald finds himself struggling with what for him are extremely complicated moral choices between the part of himself that was brought up thinking there's a single right thing to do and you'll know what it is and you'll do it, that rather sort of old-fashioned Scottish Sunday school idea, if you will, and this much more complex model of morality that he finds himself facing as he tries to weigh the good of his children against justice, against Viv's well-being, against his own situation.
Does he come to a conclusion?
I think Donald does come to a conclusion. It's a hard-won conclusion. It's not the conclusion everyone would make, I think, but I think it, for me, it felt like the right conclusion for him. Hmm. The only conclusion which would enable him to continue looking at himself in the mirror, as the phrase goes.
Right, and I think it often does come down to that, especially as we grow older.
Absolutely, and I think that sense of what we can live with grows more intense with each decade.
I spoke with the author of a book the other day, a book about writing, Alice Madison, and a book about writing, mostly writing fiction. And one of the things that she says in her book is that novelists don't necessarily write, you know, unless they're writing an autobiographical novel, they're not writing, you know, the details necessarily of their lives, but something about their lives. Maybe they take something about their lives and then exaggerate it in a novel. I wondered if that was, you know, whether this novel, Mercury, Margot Livesey, whether this novel sprang from moral quandaries that you faced in your life and the choices that you made.
this is a very sort of probing question. I think it sprang from several sources. Perhaps the most immediate I can point to was when I wrote a column for the Boston Globe in 2009. About my attempts to buy a gun in Massachusetts. I didn't actually end up buying a gun, but I did do a gun safety course and sort of went through some of the necessary steps. And in response to that column, I got, you know, an enormous number of emails and half a dozen rather sinister phone calls on my home telephone from people complaining about the article, and I realized I had really touched a nerve, even in seemingly liberal Massachusetts. And that really got my attention. And I think that another aspect was what I said earlier about, you know, what happens when one partner in a couple changes their mind about commonly held beliefs. I'm happy to say that my husband and I are in accord about many major issues, but a number of couples I know are split on political issues, on issues of social justice in ways that they find very difficult, and I watch these conversations with fascination. And years and years ago, when I was still at school, I faced this kind of dilemma about my father, after he finished teaching at the boys' private school, taught at the boys' half of the school I attended, and some pupils were doing drugs, and which was extremely transgressive at that time in that place. And I did face the sort of the challenge of what to do about it, given my father's position in the school. And I won't tell you what I did.
Okay. But yes, I can see where that, the issue of loyalty, the issue of ethics, higher ethics, that all comes into play in there.
Exactly. And, you know, challenge of being torn between my family and my peer group and, the laws of the school and the land, as it were.
Right. Well, Margot Livesey, you have written another wonderful novel. It's called Mercury, and thank you so much for talking with us again here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for these wonderful, intelligent questions. Thank you so much, Francesca.
Novelist Margot Livesey. Read an excerpt from her new novel, Mercury, at writersvoice.net. Next up, Alice Madison on writing. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Normally, books about writing make me anxious. That's because writing itself makes me anxious. I'm always comparing myself to the great writers I read, many of whom I bring to you on this show. Books about writing have all sorts of prescriptions in them that, if I could follow them, I probably wouldn't need to read the book. So when I was sent Alice Madison's book, The Kite and the String, by the publisher, Penguin Random House, I put the book on a shelf for a few weeks before I dared open it. But the title kept on calling me. The Kite and the String? What does that mean? Well, I had to at least start reading the book to find out. The genius of this slim volume is that Madison has been there. She's had the self-doubts, the second guesses, the struggles to find her voice, and found a way through the Scylla and Charybdis of too much overthinking on the one hand and too much sloppy license on the other. Her subtitle says it all, How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. Alice Madison has published 6 novels as well as 4 collections of short stories and a collection of poems. She's taught at Brooklyn College, Yale University, and for the last 21 years in the Bennington Writing Seminars, the MFA program at Bennington College. Well, Alice Madison, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
I loved this book, The Kite and the String. Unlike so many writing books that actually cause a lot of anxiety in me, this one soothes my anxieties. The subtitle is How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. First, tell us, what is the symbolism of the title, The Kite and the String?
The Kite and the String has to do with letting loose and keeping control. And I think this is something I've known about for many, many years as a writer. I guess I first had the thought when I was teaching basic writing in a community college that I realized that my students needed to do 2 different separate things, that there were times when they needed to let loose and not be constrained and not be judging themselves every second. And then, having done that, they needed to go back and say, well, is this spelled correctly? And does the first thing come first? And do I need to change it around? And so that it required, and this is not a tremendously original idea to me, but it's a very important idea to me, that writing well requires the capacity to be as free as can be and then to take some kind of control. Letting whatever is held inside free, which gives you the potential to surprise yourself, to write something you didn't know you thought or didn't know you were going to write.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which you talk about freeing that imagination of the writer within the context of control. One of the things you say is that the opposite of every rule is sometimes true. And for example, there's the rule, write what you know. But you say writing what you don't know is equally good. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I sometimes meet nervous writers who feel that if only someone could tell them the rules, then they'll be able to do it. But I think it's a mistake to rely too much on those rules. I mean, all of the familiar rules were worked out because they are often useful, but often they're not. I guess the rule I take most cautiously is show, don't tell, which is, you know, the sort of familiar dictum from writing classes that instead of saying, you know, Peter was frightened, you somehow say what was going on and what Peter did. And, you know, the bear came rushing closer to Peter. You don't need to say he was frightened. So it's true if you can evoke what is actually happening, if you can show it, if you can let us see it, then that's better. So very often in writing, that is what you want to do. But then you get people who want to get across that Peter is a veterinarian, and they can't seem to bring themselves to say Peter was a veterinarian. So they have to say something like, in his practice, where Peter sometimes found himself, spaying kittens, you know, I mean, it's allowed to tell, too. And sometimes it makes most sense to tell. And sometimes even saying Peter was frightened is the best way if Peter's fear is not the main part of the scene, but you just want to get it in there. So I think all of these rules are good to consider. Is this what I want to do now? Is this not what I want to do now? They're guides for thinking about the issues more than guides for doing what the rule says to do.
Yeah, and also point of view. You have a very in-depth discussion of the idea of point of view. Tell us about point of view.
Yeah, I think if we think of it just as point of view, then we'll think of it as a device. But what point of view really is claiming to be somebody else, pretending to be somebody else. And you can't really write without not just taking on a point of view, but really inhabiting it or letting it inhabit you. I think this is certainly true for fiction when, you know, your story says, I am 29 years old and I live in Hartford, Connecticut, when in fact you're not, you know. But I think it's also true for memoir that you're entering a former self or entering a self with a very different attitude, perhaps, than the self you have now. And we have to do that sympathetically. Sometimes when people write memoir, for example, or even fiction about someone who's going to change, they just can't bring themselves not to describe the person initially with so much disdain that, you know, kind of like, ugh, you know, I thought that this was what I wanted to do. Here I did this. Here I did that. Now I see I don't want to do that. We have to sympathize with that person, even if it was ourself. I think point of view is very hard but very exciting. You let yourself be someone else, and it turns out that we have enough knowledge of other people that we've acquired from living in the world that you do begin to sense what that person would do and what that person would feel. feel, and you know what flavor ice cream that person would want, and things like that, and who we'd vote for, you know, as minor and as major as that.
Now, another thing you say in this book, The Kite and the String, is that characters and plot are actually inseparable. You know, this is something you hear a lot from your students. Oh, you know, I'm good at characters, but I can't do plots, or vice versa. Say why that's a red herring.
I don't know how to think about character aside from plot, or plot aside from character. I mean, the part of who a character is what the character does. So, you know, if I know that Mary is going to jump in her car and drive as fast as she can to another state in order to meet Bill, then I know something about the story, and I also know something about Mary, about the kind of person she is, as opposed to someone who's just going to stay home and write Bill a letter or go down to the train station and wait for the train to come in and thoughtfully get on the train and get ready to see Bill, and you know, and so on. She's somebody, depending on what she does. And I think it's too hard to dream up plot without knowing who the people are, and also very hard to dream up character without knowing what they're going to do. The figuring it all out together is easier for me. I don't really understand how people do it differently.
Hmm.
You know, and people point out that, you know, if you took Hamlet and you put him into Othello, he would absolutely see through Iago. He would not be taken in. And if you took Othello and put him into Hamlet, he would go and kill the king. I mean, he would not stand around dithering. So the story is certainly, I think, for all writers, part of the character. And it's just a question of whether you're going to plan it that way, come at it that way. And for me, it's easier.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist and writing teacher Alice Madison about her book, The Kite and the String, How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. Now, some of the parts of this book that I think hit home the most to me were the ones about silence and self-censorship. In other words, barriers to writing.
That's central for me too. That chapter started as a lecture. Several of them started. I teach in a low residency MFA program, and they encourage the teachers to lecture now and then. And several of them started as lectures. And that one especially, I was talking to my own students. I began to notice that especially women, not just women, but especially women, often seem to feel that they didn't have permission to write. You know, that if a male writer's mother gets sick, he thinks, I should work really hard and have enough money that if my mother needs something, I can get it for her. And the female writer thinks, I should stop writing and go and take care of my mother. And maybe women are, maybe that's good, I don't know, but all kinds of things make us think we shouldn't write or that we should do something else. And I do think for some men, especially men from groups that have been oppressed at one point or another, I think, you know, men of color or gay men may also have this problem. But women too, women especially, I think we have to go out of our way to encourage one another and to grant ourselves permission to write, not to turn into horrible, selfish people who leave the children to starve, but to figure out a way that you can make supper and get some writing done. And if the supper is less elaborate or later than it might have been, nobody will starve to death. I see all kinds of things in people's prose that seems to me to come out of an excess of nervousness and a sense of who am I to intrude on the world and raise my voice. Mm-hmm. Things like writing something that's hard to follow, that doesn't quite make sense, not coming out and saying what you mean.
Yeah, and you give the example of Tilly Olson, which I found quite striking. I mean, there were competing, there was a competing claim on her attention, but my sense is that it was a lot more than that. So tell us about Tilly Olson. You know,
Tilly Olson is a wonderful writer, and I'd love it if this interview results in more people reading her work. She was born in 1912 and died early in the 21st century. She was the child of communists, of radicals from Russia. She was actually born in Nebraska, and she lived most of her life in California and was a communist during the 30s, as she was a young woman, and was an active communist who worked at Communist Party headquarters typing. And she was also a writer. And the political demands kept her from writing a lot of the time, and so did all kinds of other demands. She had four kids. She was married twice and had four children and was very active in all sorts of things. But I think also obviously felt some kind of constraint that kept her from doing it. So her entire output consisted of one book of short stories, which has four stories in it, called Tell Me a Riddle, which has gotten to be pretty well known, so maybe people will have heard of that. The first story is the one that's anthologized the most, and it's called I Stand Here Ironing. And I remember when I came across it, wow, you mean you can write a story about standing here and ironing? It was very important to me that somebody was writing about ordinary life and the life of a woman and the life of a woman who had kids and the life of a woman who did the physical work of whatever it happens to be, of being a householder. She had a contract for a novel and never was able to finish it. Was interrupted a whole lot and interrupted herself and so on. The novel, pieces of the novel were eventually published, and it's called Yonandio. And it's very good as far as it goes. And she wrote a few other essays and stories. Some of her work has relatively recently been published by her daughter. It's wonderful work, and maybe it makes it even more wonderful that you feel that she worked so hard on it and so intensely that she could do very little. It's at a fever pitch. It's beautiful prose, and she has just a wonderful eye for how people live and how they feel and what it's like to be alive.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Alice Madison about her wonderful book about writing, The Kite and the String. Now, this book is mostly about fiction, but it also applies to memoir. Why? What is the connection between fiction and memoir?
Well, fiction and memoir are so close, to the point that a lot of what we now call memoir was called fiction a while ago. I mean, especially if you fictionalized a little of it, when people sat down to write, say, a book about their own life, they might change a few things or maybe not change a few things, just change the names and call it an autobiographical novel. So I think it's quite natural to think of fiction and memoir as similar. And in both cases, we're telling a story. We're trying to get down on the page human beings that feel real. And often in fiction, we are working from something that's partly factually true. In memoir, mostly we give ourselves the rule of being absolutely factually true, but certainly memoirists sometimes will say, as Vivian Gornick does, for example, she'll say, some of these people are composites, and I've made up a few details, or I've combined some incidents. So even many memoirists are fictionalizing to a degree. And I guess, I mean, as soon as something is on the page, rather than in three-dimensional real life, it is fiction to an extent. We can't ever reproduce life on the page. So even if you set out to get your uncle and what he did down on the page, precisely as it happened. It can't be done. You don't remember. He did not consist of words. He consisted of flesh and blood. So, yeah, I think fiction and memoir are very similar. Memoirists don't have the freedom to say, well, what the story needs is for him to have another brother. I'm going to make up another brother. Then you've become a novelist. But if you're not letting yourself do that, which is an interesting challenge, I mean, they're equally interesting challenges, then it is memoir, but it's not all that different.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist and writing teacher Alice Madison about her book, The Kite and the String, How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. One of the things that has stymied me is that I'm not sure what genre it is. It seems like it's creative nonfiction, it's memoir, and I've toyed with the idea of interspersing it with actual fiction. This is a story about my father, who during World War II was a member of the Dutch underground and sheltered a Jewish man in his apartment and was part of a very interesting, rather odd group that was headed by a German emigre who was gay and who saved his young Jewish male refugees, largely because he loved them and was in love with them. They were adolescents, however. So it's an interesting story. They survived by means of poetry and art in this kind of underground cell. And I did not grow up with my father. So very much this has been a process of me finding out who he was, what really made him tick. My mother and I left him when I was 3.5, and I only met him a couple of times in my life and then began to find out the story after he died. So here we are, where there is memoir, me finding out about my father. There is creative nonfiction. I probably know more about this group than even the individual members of it because I've done so much research.
Yeah.
But there's so many lacunae. There's so many holes.
Right.
There are things I don't know about. I never did get to talk to any of them except my father, and he really didn't want to speak very much about the group. So I don't really know who they were, and it's very hard to get inside their point of view. And so I thought, yeah, maybe those are the fictional parts. What does one do with such an incredible mess?
That's so interesting. Because you could go in one of two directions, basically. You could say, okay, I'm going to fictionalize this. Or you could say, I am not going to fictionalize this. I'm going to write what I know. I mean, when you first started to talk, I thought, hell, make it a novel. But, you know, enter into the viewpoint of these people during the war, which, you, of course, you know, even if your father had told you in detail, you still wouldn't be able to really know. You'd have to be guessing, as a historical novelist does. But really, it sounds as though the act of trying to find out is almost as interesting as the story itself. I've come across books like that, I'm sure you have too, where writers write about, often it is family history, where the real subject of the book is the writing of the book. The effort to find out what actually did happen.
Oh, absolutely. And also, the most interesting questions arise out of that process. I mean, I grew up thinking my father was a crazy old coot. Then I find out he's a war hero.
Yeah.
Then I find out that the war heroes are men with feet of clay.
And then
I find out, you know, that's life.
Yeah. So inevitably, you are an important character in this story. Your idea about your father and the other people. I mean, that seems like a very, very interesting part of it, is your changing idea of who he was.
Yes, but here's the issue. So I say this to people, and they say, well, you know, you have to pick one or the other, because, you know, they won't know, the publishers won't know how to sell this book. They won't know what shelf to put it on in the bookstore.
Right. How about doing it as fact, as the memoir of your account, your attempt to find out what happened, putting in what you've learned, and at times saying, I don't know what happened in July. Here's what I imagine.
Yeah.
So acknowledging that at this point you're making it up.
I like that.
So that then the whole thing, I mean, so you have made up your mind, the whole thing is true, and you're selling it as creative nonfiction. It's not really memoir, I guess, because it's not the story of your growing up. It's the story of your thoughts about this one particular topic. But I think you could. I think you could. I think you could invent, sort of, in order to make your point. You know, it's impossible for me to think about Margaret without thinking that something like this must have happened. Blah, 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 in which Margaret is evil, or Margaret is wonderful, or something. There must have been something like this, but I don't know what it was. I can't find. You know, I've looked here and there, and I can't find it.
Exactly. In fact, there yeah. is a very central thing there about two people who I know were betrayed. I
yeah.
have some ideas about who they were who betrayed them to the Gestapo, and they both lost their lives in the concentration camps, the only members of the group to do that. You know, I can't come out and say I know it was this person who did it, but I certainly have done a lot of
right.
thinking about
right.
who did it.
Yeah. So that seems like you could say that.
Yeah. That is so wonderful. Maybe I'll come to your MFA program, and I guess on that, tell us a little bit about the MFA program at Bennington and why it's a good idea for people to go to MFA programs.
Oh, gosh. I think it's wonderful. I mean, obviously it's not something that everybody needs to do. Plenty of writers don't. But it's a low residency program, which means that the whole school, which is about 85 students and about 20 teachers, convenes for 11 days in January and 11 days in June. They always call it a 10-day residency, but it's actually 11 days. I don't know why they do that. And during the 11 days, it's this literary orgy of workshops and conferences and readings and all kinds of wonderful things, which keep your head just sparkling and jumping and dancing. And then each time you go to a residency, you do it for 4 semesters, and you get a new teacher each time. So you say if you started in January, then you would be working with one teacher, and then in June you'd switch to a different teacher, and in January again, and in June again, and then you graduate. And then you correspond with that teacher once a month for the next 5 months. So you get, we used to always do it with the post office. You know, you'd send a priority mail envelope, and some of us still do. Some of us do it by email. I have them come in by email, but I don't like to read on the computer, so I print them out and I mail them back to them. So we all have our different ways. But what happens is I get a lot of stuff, like maybe 30 pages or more of writing every month, and I read it, and they write little responses to books they've been reading, and they have a book list, and sometimes they write little essays, and then I mail it back to them. So it's two things, really. It's a community of writers. People make intense, long-lasting friendships. People of all ages and all sorts and all backgrounds. And also it's a way of getting advice about your work, which, when you get to the correspondence part of the semester, is very, very much about your work. The teachers become very, very focused on exactly what you're trying to do in this novel. And often I'll find myself saying, well, you know, ordinarily this, I wouldn't think this would be, but here, look, with this, yes, do this now. I love the job. I've done it for many, many years. I think it's, I mean, it costs money and not everybody can afford it, but if you can, I think it's great. It's like this great privilege to think about your work and have other people thinking about your work and get to know other writers. And every time I go, I come home with a list of books to read. You know, it's an education.
Well, that's wonderful. And are they always just about fiction, or are there also MFA programs?
We have at Bennington, we have fiction, nonfiction, and poetry.
Oh.
And we also have a dual genre option. People can do like 2 semesters of one and 3 semesters of another. And we have another option where people can do 3 in 1, too. That's another possibility. But mostly people work in either fiction, nonfiction, or poetry and do the 2 years that way.
Well, this has been a wonderful discussion, Alice Madison. Very helpful to me personally, and I'm also sure helpful to our listeners who want to write. Your book is The Kite and the String, How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you. This has been so much fun. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist and writing teacher Alice Madison about her book, The Kite and the String, How to Write with Spontaneity and Control and Live to Tell the Tale. Alice Madison has published 6 novels as well as 4 collections of short stories and a collection of poems. She's taught at Brooklyn College, Yale University, and for the last 21 years in the Bennington Writing Seminars, the MFA program at Bennington College. The Kite and the String is out from Penguin Random House. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.